with a smile on your face and show the world all the love in your heart. Then people gonna treat you better. You're gonna find, yes you will, that you're beautiful.
Welcome to Your Daily Diet, a spiritual guide to a healthy body size. I'm your host, Sandra Leah. On today's edition, we'll hear from Ann Betts, the co-founder of Be Above Leadership and an international speaker and trainer on the intersection of neuroscience, coaching, and human transformation. Ann serves as the neuroscience consultant to the Coaches Training Institute. But up first, let's explore the power of your mind. Is your mind a friend or a foe? Please send me your questions at sandra@yourdailydiet.ca and I'll answer them on air. This is Your Daily Diet, a spiritual guide to a healthy body size. I'm your host, Sandra Leah. Each month, we explore how diets leave you feeling empty and feature an interview with an expert who will open your mind to new ways of relating to food and your body. The next two editions of this 10-part series will focus on food recovery through healing the mind, body, and spirit. Today's focus is the mind. This series combines my personal experience recovering from food addiction and losing over 100 pounds with expert interviews that leaves you with practical steps to start your own journey. I want to reach you if you're struggling with your weight, eating, or body image. Your Daily Diet is about creating a community of seekers open to finding a solution beyond dieting, where you, the community members, define beauty and set the standard for self-love. Together, we reclaim our power over the diet industry and expectations of beauty to find peace with food, peace with ourselves, and ultimately, peace with those around us. Please send me your questions at sandra@yourdailydiet.ca and I'll answer them on air. Let's explore the power of the mind. In today's interview with Ann Betts, she will explain how young minds are really like sponges, open and available to take in everything around them. She asks us to imagine a field of untouched snow, and each time we connect a trigger with a behavior, we create a neural pathway. The first time we create the pathway, similarly to walking through a field of snow, it's quite difficult. But each time we walk the same pathway, it becomes easier and easier. Interestingly, pathways created in childhood are the most difficult to weaken and rewire. Think back to your childhood. How did you make sense of your world? If I look back at my childhood, I was raised in a chaotic home surrounded by mental illness and violence. I can remember just being confused most of the time. See, our needs, our true nature is to be filled with happiness, curiosity, and craving love. But my environment did not respond to me. I was a neglected child and I had no idea. I didn't know that I was the dirty kid who wore the same clothes to school every day. I can remember nap time at school and how each child's cot would have a blanket, a stuffed animal, and a pillow. But my cot was bare, and this honestly confused me. I had no clue that my mother was supposed to provide for me. One day stands out in my mind. It was cold on the classroom floor, and I just couldn't fall asleep. And so this really kind teacher put her coat on top of me, and I fell fast asleep. It was just so good to be warm. In a short time after that, another teacher pulled the coat off of me and she just said it wasn't allowed. And at this time, my mind was a clean slate. I could not connect the dots. It was a mystery to me. I didn't understand what was happening because I didn't associate any particular feeling and I didn't act out in any kind of behavior. So for years, it was just this weird memory that I had until I became an adult and I understood that it was neglect. I can pinpoint the moment I began a neural pathway for food comfort. I was a really, really picky eater at the age of 4. And I ate very little and I was thin and I was kind of sick looking. And Not eating meant my mom would show concern. So I remember enjoying that. The night I lay down my first tracks in the snow is very vivid in my memory. My mother and older sister were having a fight, and they were screaming, and my sister was crying. And I was frightened, and I was desperate for it to stop. In my four-year-old wisdom, I ran to the kitchen and I grabbed some cheese and bread and I sat at my mother's feet and I started eating in front of her in the hopes to please her. She stopped fighting for a moment and she praised me. And it felt so good to know that I changed things, even for a moment. For one moment, I had controlled my environment. But the fighting continued and it woke up my father. And he came running down the steps to the basement with his belt in his hand. And I remember begging my older brother to make it stop. The rest of the night's pretty foggy for me. The neural pathway, however, was set. I was 4 years old at the time, and I would never be the same again. I had found a coping mechanism, a very destructive one. If I break down the components of making this neural pathway, it started with step one. I had a trigger, which was terror. Step two, I engaged in a behavior. I began eating. And step three, which isn't always necessary, but I was given a reward. My mother's praise, a moment of control, and I numbed out from the food. So each time I danced these three steps, the trigger, eating, feeling numb, I strengthened my neural pathway to the point where it became automatic. No different than hitting the brakes each time I see a red light. I literally was unable to control my eating, and I was desperate to stop. I invite you to start looking at your destructive behaviors and coping mechanisms. Are they as automatic as hitting the brake at a red light? Our interview today will explore the connection between food addiction and neural pathways and offer ways to weaken and create new neural pathways. Ann Betts is the co-founder of Be Above Leadership and an international speaker and trainer on the intersection of neuroscience, coaching, and human transformation, and serves as the neuroscience consultant to the Coaches Training Institute. A certified professional coach for over 14 years, she is the neuroscience consultant author of a groundbreaking white paper on brain research and coaching. She's the lead author of Integration, The Power of Being Coactive in Work and Life, which is an exploration of consciousness and the future. Anne excels at making the complexities of the brain come to life with depth, humor, and simplicity. Welcome, Anne.
Thanks, Sandra. This is great to be here. I'm excited about this conversation.
So am I. Can you tell us about your work in neuroscience and coaching?
Yeah, it came about because I've actually been fascinated with human consciousness for, I think, pretty much my whole life. And for many years have been exploring, you know, really like what makes us tick, what makes us grow, and coaching is part of that. About 4 or 5 years ago, I really saw that neuroscience was coming to the forefront of our understanding of you know, how we operate. And I like to say, you know, we've got this amazing brain and nobody gave us a user's manual. So I'm trying
so
to
true.
Create a bit of a user's manual. And when I went to school and studied neuroscience, I started seeing that so much of what we do, those of us who are professional coaches, what we do in the coaching relationship was right in alignment with what neuroscientists were telling us the brain responds to really well. You know, just anything from the research on stress, which says that if you help someone focus on their values or you help them take a new perspective or you help them become more present, you will alter their internal chemistry and give them a sense of reducing stress. And it was, you know, when I read that, I was like, well, geez, this is what I'm trained to do. So I just love this, and we go around the world teaching coaches who already have experience, who go around the world and we teach them how to bring neuroscience into their practices, how to understand more about what they're already doing, and then take on some new tools and techniques that are incredibly effective in helping people transform.
Do neural pathways play a part in any of this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They are totally at the core of, I think, you know, when I look at what we're doing as coaches, you know, I can't really even start to have the conversation if I don't talk about the process of neuroplasticity, the ability of the brain to grow and change, because I think that's at the core of any change. And I know we're going to be talking about weight and diet and all of that today. We have to rewire our existing neural pathways. And that is the sort of the good news is that that's absolutely possible. The bad news is that it takes grit and determination, and you have to really be in the game to do it.
Right, because sometimes our neural pathways are created in childhood.
Yeah, a lot of our, a lot of our, the stuff that we're trying to move beyond as we become more aware, the reason it's so hard to move beyond is it gets structured at a point in time where our brains were very spongy and open, and we were learning who we are, and we're learning things like language. And, you know, we're also learning what kind of adults are safe and what aren't, and, you know, if I be this kind of person, what kind of reaction do I get? And so the things, it's like you never totally forget your first language. Well, that's because it gets laid down in the brain in a time, I think of it sort of like things that, like the cement is soft, and what you write in that cement stays. Now, it can be changed, but the stuff we learn early in life takes more dedication to changing it.
That makes so much sense, because I know in my history, I started using food as a drug quite early in life, probably at the age of four. And I understood that when I was scared or when I was angry, that food would soothe me. I created a neural pathway.
Yeah. And then what we do and what we know about neural pathways in the brain is that every time we use them, they get stronger. So every time we send an impulse down a pathway, either by thinking or by doing something, it becomes stronger and more dominant. So, you know, learning something when you're four, you know, I can so relate to that, because I remember being about eight and, you know, going through life like just life was great. And my father, who had a lot of triggers for himself, he'd been a fat kid and been teased a lot by it. He got really hooked about my weight, which wasn't particularly high, just was a little chunky, you know, like kids go in and out of chunky phases. Well, you know, he put me on a diet at age eight. So I've got these old neural pathways that say, to be loved, I need to be thin.
What role do you think neural pathways play in food addiction?
I am not an expert in the process of addiction. I know a little bit more of an expert in the process of change. But let me try not to get myself into too much trouble, but let me talk a little bit about it. When I think about food addiction, and, you know, there's a place where if you think about a neural pathway as being like a path through the forest, or for those of us who come from the north, a path in the snow. And if you're just standing there, you know, at some point as little children, we were just standing there and it was a fresh field of snow. And there was sort of nothing. There was just pure possibility. There were no habits. You didn't know how to do anything and you could walk in any direction. Well, you know, you walk in the food as comfort direction, or I walk in the I'm only acceptable and loved if I'm thin direction. Well, I create this pathway in the snow. And every time we walk it, it becomes easier to go that way, and the energy just naturally and without thinking flows that way. Now, with substances, including food and particularly sugar, which for many of us a more difficult part of food addiction things, sugar or anything that converts to sugar very easily, like carbohydrates, well, you also get tremendous chemical reward from that. And I don't know, Sandra, if you've seen any of the articles that say basically, here's your brain on cocaine, here's your brain on sugar.
Yes.
Gee, they look the same.
Yes.
It's kind of an oh shit there. Dang. So you're getting not only the habit of doing it, which is pulling your energy in that direction, and all sorts of associations that could trigger along with that, but you've also got an immediate reward. And I like to go think, whenever I think about the brain, I really love to think about evolution and sort of how was this helpful to us in our evolution? Well, short-term gains when we were hunter-gatherers were really, really important. We were not carrying things with us. We were living in the moment. Therefore, what we can achieve short-term is primed to be of greater importance than kind of long-term gain. So if you've got the berries in front of you, you can't really carry them with you or anything like that, or in very limited quantities, so you're just going to eat as much as you can right then. Better for your survival. And in fact, for sweet foods, our brain doesn't even have an off switch. You have an off switch. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. So for like nuts and protein and vegetables and things like that, there's a certain point where your brain is just like, okay, that's enough. Done. Full. For sugar, and the theory behind this is that sugar was so rare in the natural world. It's very uncommon you come across anything with that density of calories, like honey or really sweet fruit, or, you know, it even was quite late in evolution that they figured out how to make maple syrup. So it's really rare, and it's a wonderful energy source. So when we come across honey in the honeycomb or anything like that, we're just designed to eat it all. It's really, you know, good for our survival.
That's so interesting, because I often say I don't have a full switch. My full switch over time is, you know, it broke down. And so this explains a lot for me.
Just think of yourself as, you know, evolutionarily working well. The problem is that I think, you know, in our ancestors didn't, or, you know, the evolution didn't anticipate 7-Elevens when you walk in. It's a little different than honey on the honeycomb.
Can you give us some concrete steps in either weakening neuropathways or creating new pathways?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I was just thinking that myself, sort of like, okay, well, that was the bad news. Now, what do we do with it? I like to say our brains are three-year-olds, and it's much easier to get our brain to go towards something than to go away from it. So, you know, just like trying to stop a three-year-old from doing what it wants or what he or she wants is really difficult, but giving them options or giving them something bright and shiny to go towards often works much better. So when I am thinking about retraining neural pathways, especially ones with a reward there, I'm really always looking toward more reward rather than punishment. It really sets up a negative pattern in the brain to kind of try to tough your way through weight loss in particular. There's all sorts of wonderful research on that. So I'm always looking at rather than going away from something, trying not to do something, which we know often makes us a little bit more. You know, the classic don't think of a pink elephant. Mm-hmm. And what did you just think of?
Right. Pink elephant just appeared in my mind.
Of course it did. So if you're trying to not eat chocolate, not eat chocolate, not eat chocolate, okay, can't eat chocolate, can't eat chocolate, you know, really all you're doing is actually building a stronger desire for chocolate, and that's the research really bears this out. So much more productive to look and say, what is it that I want to bring into my diet? What is it I want to eat? Really, honestly, like, what is it I want to eat more of? You know, I'm really looking to bring in, you know, more green vegetables rather than what do I want to stop doing, because it doesn't seem, that part does not seem to work particularly well. So building up in a different direction, finding something that you're going towards rather than away from, seems to be one really practical tip there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a great way of looking at it. And I agree with you. When I have that negative, I can't, you better not, I can't believe you did that, it doesn't work out for me. And especially, you know, I don't eat perfectly because I'm not a perfect person, but I know when I've eaten in a way that I don't feel comfortable with, if I go down the path of punishing myself, I'm going to keep eating. Where I go down the path of being loving and gentle, then suddenly I can stop.
Yeah, that's really beautiful, and I think that's there's the research out. There's a couple of things that happen. One is what they call the what the hell effect. It's like, what the hell? I already broke my diet. You know, forget it. It's all screwed. Here's a tip, too. I'll tell a story about a friend of mine who had discovered neuroplasticity. She'd been in one of our coaching programs, and she had this huge aha because she had hypoglycemia, was really working on not eating sugar, eliminating that, which is a tough one because it has such a reward and your brain is so primed to go towards rewards, whatever they are. So she said, she told a story one night. She was, you know, like, I'm not going to have the oatmeal cookie. Now, she probably was doing a little bit of the pink elephant thing. And she said, you know, she got pretty far. She's like, I'm going to have a cup of tea and I'm going to do this. And then, you know, like 10 o'clock that night, she ate the oatmeal cookie. And she said, though, but in the past, I would have said to myself, ugh, I'm a bad person. Clearly, I can't, you know, honor my commitments. I have no integrity. I have no willpower, blah, 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 all the shame conversation. But because she understood neuroplasticity, she found herself saying to herself instead, oh, you know, every time I didn't have it, I was actually building a positive, putting positive energy down in my brain, building a different neural pathway. Then I had it. I made one mistake, so I walked that other path, so I made that other path a little stronger. So now, rather than continuing to make that path stronger, my job is to make to put energy down the other path, to walk the new direction. And so she was able to reframe this sort of, I'm a complete failure loser, into, you know, it was only one like trip down that pathway, and I can continue going down the new pathway.
Right. And then it ends
so
there.
So really, really powerful.
Yeah. That is a very powerful story, because that cookie could have turned into binging for 3 or 4 days, but instead she took on a different perspective and it just ended there.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. The other thing that happens is we get into this punishment-reward cycle that is really, I find this one super fascinating. So the research basically says, if you're going to exercise, make sure it's something that is intrinsically pleasurable if you want to lose weight. So if you just are like out to punish yourself, go right ahead, you know, go do whatever you don't, you know, work out really hard, have fun. But if you want to lose weight, what you want to do is exercise that you enjoy for its own sake, because what tends to happen with people, if they go exercise and it's just miserable, and they're like, oh my God, and okay, I'll run 5 more minutes, and they come home, is that then they reward themselves. And the research shows they end up eating more calories and they actually negate the effects of the exercise. I've struggled with it because I believe in exercise and it's important to me to be fit, but there's not a lot that I like to do. And then I remembered how much I love rollerblading. So I rollerblade. And I was thinking about this because I was thinking about our call today, and I got home last night and I'd been rollerblading, and because it is a joy in and of itself, I come home and I'm not going to the refrigerator to, you know, look for that thing to kind of make me feel better, because I already feel great. I was doing my fun thing.
Yeah, exactly. I do want to talk about your new book, Integration, The Power of Being Coactive in Work and Life. Tell us what coactive means.
Coactive is the model of coaching that I was trained in, and it is the model of coaching that was developed by the Coaches Training Institute, and they're one of the very first coaching schools in the country, and you were trained through that model as well.
Yes, I'm certified.
Certified as coach. A coactive
yes.
coach.
Exactly.
So there's about, 30,000 of us in the world or something crazy like that. And it's this, what was really revolutionary about it is that it's a model that very much includes both being and doing. Rather than looking at human development, like, what are you going to do? When are you going to do it? Come on, let's go. There's a lot of skills and tools in the model that really address the motivational place. And so coactive coaches are designed to walk in both worlds. And The book was really the brainchild of me and Karen Kinsey House, who's one of the founders, and we basically started writing it because we asked each other, what's the biggest problem in the world today? And we had the same answer, so it seemed a good idea to write a book. And our answer was, people feel separate. They feel separate from themselves. They feel separate from each other. They feel separate from their organizations. They feel separate from their government. You know, there's this feeling of, like, somehow we've lost the ability to deeply melt into each other.
That's beautiful.
The sweetness of that.
Yeah, and you share your own story of feeling alone and apart from others.
Yeah, absolutely. Both Karen and I realized we had a really early story. For me, it was losing my hair when I was 17. And the truth is, we are so profoundly interconnected. But at the time, I made up that I wasn't as good as other people, and that if people knew this about me, they wouldn't love me. And, you know, I was somehow not as, you know, like, I would watch the Pepsi commercials on TV, and I would just think, I'm not part of that. And had a realization pretty early on that for me it was my hair, for Karen it was her weight, but for most people there's something. And so this is not so much personal that this terrible thing happened to me, but it was more gave me a window into the human condition. And I think that window really spurred my whole career of saying, how do we really, you know, relate to each other and be connected with each other. And so the reason that we call it integration is that in looking at all of this and looking at the co-active model, the being and doing, is that it's not one or the other. It's not that we're either separate or connected. There's a power to being separate. There's a power to me knowing who I am, having boundaries, having clarity, taking a stand for something in the world. Even as I'm telling you this, I'm standing up straighter. But also being permeable and being available to be changed and to grow. So that's this place, you know, clarity and permeability that feels like separate and connected. And then we realize that the tools of this co-active model of coaching were all designed to help people either develop more clarity about who am I, what kind of boundaries do I need to have, and more deeply connect with others. Hmm. So that's the kind of the premise and where the book goes.
And to quote the book, it is becoming clearer that as humanity, we are facing what Joanne Marcy calls the great turning.
Yeah, Joanna Macy. She's talking about, you know, there's this great evolutionary turning, and so we get a little highfalutin in the book, but I really believe this. So here's the way that I hold it. You know, in my studies of neuroscience and evolutionary biology and all of that, there was a time where we were tribal, and we felt connected within our tribes. We were hunter-gatherers, and this is most of human history, 190,000 years of human history, which is about 200,000 years old. So we felt we moved together, we knew each other, we probably had much more of what we would call a group mind. And there's a real beautiful comfort to that, you know, sleeping together under the stars, everyone watching everyone's children. And there's a lot of people today who have like a lot of nostalgia for that. Like, how come we can't go back to that? Let's go back. That seems so nice, you know. And so there is this longing within us. And yet, we've spent the last 10,000 years getting clearer about what's possible for human beings and creating and being able to be individuals and be able to step outside the group and be able to push things forward, which a group can't always do, but an individual can. And we've pushed that to, we've pushed this beautiful kind of creativity and inspiration, but I think we've actually pushed it beyond, you know, as far as we want it to go. We've become really, really individual. Mm-hmm. So for me, the next great turning is to integrate the two, to figure out how we are deeply and profoundly connected with all of our wonderful, beautiful differences. I want people to understand this because I think sometimes there's this view of, you know, let's become more of the we. It's all about the we, and everything is in the we, and let's all, you know, work together better and have these, you know, flat organizations, and I'm not opposed to any of that. What is often not talked about is in order to create a powerful we, what needs to happen is the I's need to be honored and need to be very clear about who they are. This comes from the work of a really brilliant man called Dan Siegel, Dr. Dan Siegel, who's one of the real leading lights. I think he's going to go down in history as a major thinker of this age. And he says integration is the linkage of differentiated parts. And what I'm seeing right now is there's a lot of talk about linkage, and not necessarily enough talk about differentiation, because that's what we have been doing. And so people are sort of wanting to ping-pong over to, oh, well, differentiation didn't work, everybody's so separate, da-da-da, silos, and saying, so let's reject that. That's bad. Now let's go to oneness. No. The next great turning is to stand on what we've learned about being tribal and what we've learned about being separate and integrate it and bring the best of both.
So how can people become more connected?
I think, ironically, one of the ways we become more connected often starts with learning more about who we are personally. So if I think about if you and I are going to work on a project, what I want is 100% human being over there. I want to work with someone who knows who she is, who knows what, you know, is in bounds and out of bounds, knows what, you know what you want to do and what your purpose is. And I'm bringing the same. I'm very clearly differentiated. Because if I know who I am and you know who you are, and, you know, there's enough, still also enough room and interest in being changed by each other, we can create something powerful. But if I come to you and I haven't done my own work and I just kind of, you know, want to hang out because I think you're so cool, but I don't really know who I am or what I have to offer, there's not a full person there to work with. So ironically, paradoxically, I think differentiation is part of deep connection. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
It does. In a way, it's also saying the more at peace I am with myself, the more at peace I can be with you.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful, concise way of putting it. I love that.
And we also become comfortable in our own greatness, and then I can recognize your greatness. So, I feel that that's really one of those keys to connection. And in the book, you talk about being separate within ourselves.
Yeah, I see that a lot. And I think this is one of the things I love about the coactive model. And we talk about some of the tools to help kind of create a unified whole. Because I think and again, this goes back to what we were talking about in childhood, there's rooms that we've closed off. Because, nobody celebrated that part of ourself, or we tried it once and we were criticized. So we just closed the door to that part of us. You know, I think about in my family, particularly my brother, I was a pretty exuberant kid and was into theater and, you know, but he was always saying, stop being so dramatic. Well, there was a point at which, you know, in order to get his approval, and he's my older brother, and I loved him, and I love him, you know, I took that in. I internalized this, and there's a room in my house called, you know, full self-expression, you know, the five-year-old who gets up on top of the table and pretends to do TV commercials. Well, that room got closed, and yet that's a part of me, and my journey, and as I learned to be a coach and learned in this model that every part of me had gifts, I was able to open that room again and find this part and bring it out. And if I hadn't, I wouldn't be able to be the leader that I am now.
Mm. Yeah. I think there's a 5-year-old locked in all of us, to be truthful.
I think I still have five-year-olds locked in different rooms. You know, there's always more, like, what else did I shut off?
There was an interesting study in the book where they measured creativity at the age of four or five. Can you take us through that study?
If I can, I'll do my best to remember it. Yeah, it was, and I don't remember where it was from or anything. I'd have to go back and look at the reference in the book. But it basically what it was is that there's a creativity test, and I believe it's a test used by NASA. Creativity is highly prized in organizations today, and as it should be. And they give it to, like, five-year-olds, and they score off the charts. And then it goes basically goes down from there. And I don't remember the numbers, but let's just say, you know, it's like 75% of five-year-olds just sort of score in the genius area. And then by the time they get to 8 or 10, it's down to, like, 25%. And then by the time they're an adult, it's like, you know, 1 out of 20. And those numbers are off, but they're roughly accurate. And it's, you know, the argument is that, like, our creativity is innate, and yet it gets sort of programmed out of us.
And to heal that separation within ourselves is connecting again to that creative being,
unlocking her from the room. And it's you know, I don't believe in just the research is now showing it's not just simply right and left brain. And if you're in a creative process, you're going to get firing on both the right side of the brain and the left side of the brain. However, there is a way that being that open, being that curious, and being that aware of what's going on and what's possible is probably a little more of a right brain skill. And what I see in the world today is that it's more left brain skills and perspectives that are being so rewarded in the workplace. And so when I think about integration as a coach and as a trainer, a lot of what I'm doing in the corporate world is I'm giving rational and logical explanations for why people need to open some of these other doors to finding the pieces of themselves that are less logical, less rational, but hold immense creativity.
Hmm. Beautifully put. How can people find out more about you and your work?
Well, you can find me on Facebook, and there's a book, there's a page for Integration, the book on Facebook, if you just look for Integration. And then my website is www.beaboveleadership.com, and that has all sorts of information about our coaching programs.
Thank you. Thank you for your time today, and you are true to your reputation. You have brought the complexities of the brain to life with humor and simplicity and depth, and in a way that I feel that everyone will get so much out of this. Thank you so much. That was Ann Betts, neuroscience consultant and co-founder of Be Above Leadership. To clarify on the study of creativity Ann was describing, it took place in 1968. George Land gave 1,600 children aged 5 a creativity test used by NASA to select innovative engineers and scientists. He then retested the same children at ages 10 and 15. The test results were amazing. At age 5, 98% of children registered genius creativity level. 30% remained at this level at age 10 and only 12% at age 15. The same test was given to 280,000 adults, and only 2% would be placed at genius level creativity. This study shows that non-creative behavior is learned, that creativity is inherent in human beings, our very birthright. In losing this, we lose ourselves. Our journey is about finding our way back to our true self. Now let's pick up on the theme. Is your mind a friend or a foe? As a young adult, I believe my perception had collapsed. So what do I mean by that? I had developed neural pathways that told me to eat when I was scared, sad, lonely. Over time, any of life's problems were answered by eating. And then celebrating and socializing, they all meant eating. All roads led there. But ultimately, I used food to numb out. And you cannot just numb out the bad feelings. You cut out all feelings, including joy and happiness. Not only was I a food addict by this time, I was maladapted to life. I had not learned how to handle life's disappointments or grow as a person through difficult times. Instead, any time I was faced with something I could not face, I drew the blinds, I hid, and I ate. I stopped maturing emotionally. Over time, my mind did turn on me. It told me I had no right to be a part of this world that valued being thin so highly. My mind told me the more I weighed, the less I was worth. It told me I was stupid, fat, and unlovable. We all have mental tapes that are playing in the background, sort of like the soundtrack to your life. Events will often trigger these tapes, so things like making a mistake, getting a bad grade, the girl or guy not into you, we all have our go-to mental tapes. Do you ever stop and have a good listen? My mental tape was probably one of the most discouraging, hopeless tune I could ever sing to myself. Taking care of my bipolar mother often triggered it, and it went something like this. My life is horrible. It's never going to get better. It's only going to get worse. And I would play this over and over in my mind, and I would play it when I was the most upset. Well, if you repeat something long enough with enough intensity, you'll believe it. And if it becomes a belief in your life, it will show up in your life. And I did a great job of it. I thought my way into becoming a 29-year-old who weighed 262 pounds, unable to work, on a cocktail of antidepressants and mood stabilizers. I could not take another step. I wanted to die. Wanting to die should not shock you. If you think back to my mental tape, my life is horrible, it's never going to get better, it's only going to get worse, would you even want to get out of bed if this was your belief? So I had to come up with a new tape that I would repeat often with great emotional intensity. And the trigger for my new tape would be the beginning of my old tape. I would literally hit the stop button and replace it with the new mental tape, which was, my life is filled with blessings and miracles. My life is filled with blessings and miracles. And I would play this tape at the most difficult times. As you know, I cared for my mom, and she died a food addict. Diabetes had ravished her body. She had nerve damage in her knees and could not walk unassisted. Her eyesight was failing. She had lost all her teeth, and she was incontinent. I remember being at a busy mall, and she had just soiled her pants. I had to walk her to the bathroom. That day, I created a new neural pathway. I held my head up high, I pulled back my shoulders, and I proudly walked my mom to the bathroom as I repeated, my life is filled with blessings and miracles. I repeated my mental tape often, and it manifested in my life. As you begin to consider how to weaken and rewire neural pathways in your life, start with recognizing the triggers. If you know loneliness leads to eating every time, then you've got a chance. You know the trigger. Next time you're about to use food, pause. If you can manage a pause, just enough time and space where you can reach for a tool or a lifeline, know ahead of time which tools serve you best. Is it breathing, walking, giving your body water, making a phone call, prayer? Each time you choose different, your neural pathway weakens. Every time you lay down new tracks in the snow, it gets easier to follow the pathway. Today we have time to answer a question from Jessica, who lives in Milton. Jessica writes, I'm about to start a weight loss challenge at work. Each week we will be weighed to keep everyone accountable, and the challenge will end by Christmas. I'm so excited to be thinner for the holidays. How do you suggest I prepare? Thank you for the question, Jessica. I don't think you're going to like my answer. I believe if you want to gain weight, go on a diet. And this has diet written all over it. My first issue is being weighed weekly. This can be really tricky. You need to know how much power that scale has over you. If you're like most women, it can control how you feel about yourself. Get really honest here. What happens if you work hard all week, eat right, exercise, and you don't lose any weight? or heaven forbid you gain weight, how will you handle that? You mentioned that the challenge ends at Christmas. What happens at Christmas? It really sets you up for restricting to get a goal, and then all bets are off at Christmas. This is the definition of yo-yo dieting. I believe every diet, every restricted meal is a binge in the bank for later. Instead, I challenge you to throw the scale in the trash bin. Eat to be sane. Move your body to be well. Find a way to nourish your body in a lifelong, sustainable way. Eliminate refined sugar and flour. Keep it simple, and I promise your body will release weight naturally.
You got to get up every morning.
That's it for your daily diet. Please tune in for the next edition on Wednesday, November 4th at 10 a.m. We will look at our spirit and how true healing and transformation is born here. Thank you to our guests, Ann Betts, and thank you to our producer, Daniela Mastercola. Be sure to check out my blog at yourdailydiet.ca, follow us on Twitter at YDD Canada, and remember, we'll be back next Wednesday, November the 4th at 10 a.m. I've been your host, Sandra Leah. You're listening to Vibe 105. Stay tuned.